Yeah, let them settle down. Yeah. Yeah.
We don't get clean glasses, do we?
Yeah, you do, you do. You do, and I think we need more water as well. Yeah. No, I was sitting there thinking, is it just the one glass for the whole day?
So it was swine flu.
Swine flu, and every other thing imaginable.
Anywhere else you want to go? Wild tangents? You just go anywhere.
Anywhere, I think, yes. Whatever I was thinking about in the last one was taken elsewhere. So. I just think when it settles down, you have to introduce yourself briefly.
Okay.
And then we just go from there.
Yeah, I'll say a little thing as well. Yeah. Get us going.
Have you been here long?
No, I went upstairs briefly, then I had to wander around and get into the mindset. You know, when you're loaded in the barrel.
Right. Are we kind of all set?
I think we are.
I think you should.
We're going, aren't we? Yes.
Yes.
I was just saying to David, we're expecting a kind of calm Buddhist swap over between one speaker and the next, but it's obviously not happening, is it?
No, it's more raggedy than that.
I'm Mark Haddon. I suppose I'll just have to say of the curious incident, which is going to live with me forever, won't I?
Probably. Right, so.
When I was listening to you before, there's something which came to mind. You know, you're talking about swimming, reverse evolution, and time, and ideas of meditation upstairs. Mm. Last year, I read Roger Deakin's wonderful book, Waterlog, about wild swimming throughout the UK. I read it, I thought, what a fantastic concept. I wish I could do it, but every time I looked at a lake or a river, I just think, there's that evil black stuff underneath with tentacles that's just going to get your feet and going to pull you down. And then about 3 or 4 months ago, I live in Oxford by the Thames, and at the end of a run, I thought, you know, what the hell? And I jumped into the river, and I've been doing it several times a week ever since, and it is one of the most peaceful, meditative things I ever do. For years, I've on and off tried to do meditation, and I've finally come to the conclusion that meditation works best in cultures where you've been working hard outside all day. Most of us spend the whole day sitting down, and then when you go and try and sit down in an entirely different way, your head is just fizzing.
Feverish.
You haven't done that hard physical work. So I've decided this is meditation for real men, you know, jumping into the river. And there's something incredibly beautiful and calming about it. I mean, you can go, you can walk, you can cycle, you can run, as I do quite a lot. But there's something about getting into a bit of the landscape with your head sticking out of it. You see things and experience things you never normally do. Just watching insects flying around your head and swifts coming down past you and sort of scooping them up and going on, or geese swimming around you.
I went to Northwest Scotland in June. I went with my wife and we did a drive. We both wanted to see Loch Ness because neither of us had seen it before. And I don't know if you've seen Loch Ness, but I mean, it is extraordinary. I mean, the blackness of it and the coldness of it. And I thought about what it would be like to swim. I mean, it's very big and, of course, famously deep, and maybe or maybe not, there's a monster. But I just thought about that idea of swimming in it, and it just seemed impossible to me, absolutely impossible.
Is fear keeping you out?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I'm very much in admiration. I haven't actually read that particular book by Roger Deakin, but I liked his book on trees very much.
Isn't it strange that we think there's a monster there? Because I think most of us, if we were there, would think that the lock itself was fairly monstrous and wouldn't want to get into it because of all that darkness. It seems rather odd to add a monster to it, doesn't it? It's just that's like the icing on the cake, because it's actually fairly scary as it is, all that darkness underneath.
Yeah. Well, I think partly the monster image must have come from the atmosphere of the lock itself. But I think partly it's that need for us to connect back to vast extents of time. You know, that there is something very compelling about that idea. And maybe it is connected to another need, which is a feeling that there must be a future, you know, so that if there is this past in which maybe there are these survivors from, you know, long extinct species, then somehow it all makes sense to us.
I think I get completely the opposite thing in places like that. As I get older, I get a stronger and stronger hunger to be out in the hills, away from other people, in places that are very silent, no human things around. We just come back from Snowdonia. And in southern Snowdonia, you can really get away from the people and be on your own. Yeah. I mean, I had two small children with me, which was a slightly different experience. Yes. But if you walk ahead of them, you can get on your own at times.
If you walk a long way ahead of them, liberating.
There's a competition to be the first person in any string of people walking, isn't there? Because if you're at the front, it's nature. If you're at the back, it's just children shouting and a bit of nature behind them.
Yeah.
I don't think it's about the stretches of time. I think when I'm in the city, when I'm in town, when I'm at home, then I get that anxiety about things which have to be done, things which have been left undone, and you can feel the past and the future. What's really wonderful about being in places like that is you actually think about the present. You know, you think about just walking earth, rock, sky. And actually, that's when I stop thinking about the future. And that's what makes me hungry for it, just to be cut off from everything else.
Does that affect you as a writer?
I used to think it did. I used to go to places like that and feel truly inspired. And until I realised that I just felt like a writer in those places, soaking it all up, being a bit Wordsworth. But in fact, I never get anything written.
No.
I think I need those things to kind of empty my head. But in fact, I never get writing done there. Yeah. I just feel slightly sort of creative. But I have to go home and I have to sit in a room staring at a wall, so there's nothing, and then I have to produce that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The other thing is just a holiday from my sort of fidgeting, worrying self.
Yeah. It's interesting that one of the first things you said was about Curious Incident, and there's a kind of, oh my God, you know, and a lot of people, of course, will give their right arm to have something that had that longevity in their career. You know, a lot of artists, writers, or whatever. Something that is identifiable and really, really lasts is not kind of in the remainder shops after 2 weeks, you know, not utterly forgotten, you know, so that people say, what book, you know? Yet there's already the sense that it's a kind of burden.
Not a burden. I mean, I say it just as a sort of shorthand if people don't know who I am, and I hope that most people have read that because it has spread around the world like swine flu, and everyone's come into contact with it somehow. There's a public side and a private side, and I don't know whether you experience this as well. You make something, and hopefully it percolates into the world, and you bump into people who've heard something or read something, or people who haven't yet. It has a life of its own. It spreads out there. But at home, you know, when you're writing, when you finish something, there's just a sort of hole there. I mean, I've just finished writing a play. I've been trying to write plays for sort of 7 years on and off, and it's been bloody hard work. I mean, I've written screenplays and radio plays, and I thought, stage, it can't be that difficult, can it? My vanity. And it is extremely difficult. Yeah. And I've finally written one, and it works, and something's going to happen to it. But then I say to my wife, she says, why are you wandering around? Can't you just congratulate yourself? I said, yeah, it worked, but what am I going to do today? So whatever success you get, it doesn't kind of feed you moment by moment. It's still a choice of, do I sit down and watch daytime television, or do I do something new? It seems ungenerous to say that kind of thing, but I think anyone who's an artist feels that. Yeah. By the time someone out there is appreciating what you've done, you're sitting there tapping your fingers thinking, I need something else to do now.
Yeah, I've done a lot of work in recent years with archive materials, both my own and other people's. And that's a strange experience, because then you really do feel this longevity. And it's not maybe something like Curious Incident, which has been a big success. It's maybe something almost lost, and it's recovered through this process of examining the archive. And you bring it into present time. You know, you expose it to whatever scrutiny it will experience right now. But if it's connected to you personally, then there's the peculiar psychology, I think, of delving that far back into your past.
So is this your own archive you're sort of trawling?
Well,
through?
It's a mixture, you know, of different archives in different projects. But it's, I mean, I think it's, you know, you get to a certain age and then inevitably you're being asked to kind of dig up all this old archive stuff.
So when you go through this archive stuff and you find stuff, are you having these grand thoughts about rescuing stuff from oblivion? Or is that just a posh thing to say to other people? And in fact, you're like a sort of kid in a sweet shop.
Well, neither. I don't feel like neither image, actually. But not grand thoughts, but yes, quite often rescuing something from oblivion.
And is that quite moving, doing that?
It can be, yeah. And if it's, you know, personal connection. And you do feel a sense, oh, people who've, you know, endured, people who've faded away, people who've died, you know, people whose work has persisted. And there's something definitely very moving about that. And then also you feel with your own kind of trajectory that, you know, you've managed to keep on doing this thing in various forms. And that in itself is well, gratifying, obviously.
Do you ever record stuff or archive stuff in such a way that you come across it and forget that it's yours?
Oh, God, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And is that a stranger feeling as it is for me? I mean, I was digging around deep in the files of my Mac the other day, and I popped up, I can't quite believe I'm saying this, a novel I'd forgotten I'd written. I read a lot, which went into my bottom drawer and have to be burned sometime, or just clean from the hard drive so that someone doesn't publish it when I die because it's dreadful.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very odd experience, thinking here's something I really put my heart and soul into and I don't remember any of it really. And it's like taking it down off a shelf in the bookshop and thinking, this is a bit crap, isn't it?
That's quite strange. That really is quite strange. I mean, I can think of, you know, specific events or small things, but not a whole novel. Because to me, the process of writing a book is, on the one hand, deeply fulfilling, and on the other hand, deeply scarring. And, you know, whatever comes of it, you know, whatever the book turns out to be, I can't imagine forgetting doing it.
But there's a difference here, isn't it? Because you're writing about stuff, aren't you? You've got quite a solid subject. Whereas if you're trying to do something literary like I'm doing, ultimately you're sort of writing about nothing. I mean, the more stuff you have in the book, the more likely it is to be a spy thriller or a romance or detective fiction.
Yeah.
Whereas my favourite writers, I mean, I'm rereading Jacob's Room by Virginia Woolf at the moment for the sort of 15th time, possibly.
It needs 15 readings before you have any idea what it's about.
But in a way, it's about nothing. It's just about people wandering through their days.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of literature aspires to that, aspires to being about almost nothing. So I think it is easier to forget a book if you're trying to write it about nothing in the first place.
One of my favourite lines from recent years is, chair creaks, but no one sits there, which is from Jacob's Room. And I actually made a piece of music year before last that was called that. It's about this idea of sound as a disturbing element and a sense or a phenomenon that inspires fear. And it's partly because sound is something that can be distanced from ourselves. You know, we can hear something, but we can't actually often see the source of the sound. And that, in childhood, when you're in bed at night in the dark and you hear a sound, you can, I used to get very frightened, and my first sensation connected with sound was in fact that kind of fear. So when I came across this line in Jacob's room, I thought that's fantastic, because it's about this idea that stuff is happening even if there's nobody there.
Well, there's that wonderful passage in the middle of To the Lighthouse, isn't there? A gap of several years between people at this holiday house in Cornwall and then back again after Mrs. Ramsay has died. And the central section is just about the house being completely empty. And it's desperately moving, just the emptiness of a house, the absence of people.
And Mrs. Dalloway, sorry to interrupt, but Mrs. Dalloway strongly connects with Long Player, I think, because, you know, the measurement in that book is from Big Ben.
And golden circles spreading in the air.
Golden circles spreading in the air. So I must talk to Jem about this. But, yes, there's a constant tolling of the bell throughout the book, which actually gives you some grounding. I think Mrs. Dalloway has that kind of grounding, whereas Jacob's room is just like everywhere, isn't it? It's just floating, and you really have to...
Well, that was especially about nothing, because it was inspired, we all assume, by the death of her brother Toby, on whom Jacob is based. And you never really see... You see inside everyone else's mind, you know, someone selling newspapers on the street, you get inside their mind briefly before coming out again. But he is this sort of cipher. He's only ever seen from the outside.
Yeah.
It's one of those books that when you read the backstory, it suddenly becomes much richer than you realise first time around.
He died in the Great War, didn't he? Yeah, that's right. So, it's very profoundly connected with a major event in human history, and yet the treatment of it is so elusive and so... you know, it sort of slips out of your fingers, and yet you have this deep resonance which is coming from all that tragedy from that period.
I think one of the real temptations you have to avoid as a writer, people regularly fall into this trap, if it is a trap, certainly a trap from my point of view, is trying to be too contemporary, trying to sort of write about everything that's happening around you. But when you look back, that's... The events that were happening around the subjects of a really great novel are just a little bit of scaffolding here and there. Mm. And the things that really last are just about what it's like to be a person sitting in a room, waking up in bed, walking through the streets of London.
Mm.
And there might be wars going on, there might be terrorist attacks, but those, they come and go. You know, they're the sort of background, the background wave.
Yes, yeah. It's interesting. I'm sorry to drag you back to this, but I read Curious Incident because my daughter read it and she was very enthusiastic about it. And she said, you should read this. So I read it and I really enjoyed it. But I was talking to her yesterday. I mean, she knew that I was doing this conversation with you, and she was quite excited about that, although not excited enough to give up her babysitting job to come and hear it, I have to say. But I said, I'm just trying to figure out in my mind, you know, how Mark's book relates to this whole theme here of, you know, longevity, duration, extendedness of time, and so on. And she said, habit. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Habit. And why do you say habit? And she said, well, you know, this way of dealing with life for a person who experiences life as he does, and developing certain rituals and habits and, you know, methods of engagement that are tolerable or that make sense of the world.
Well, because by repeating stuff, you can sort of give the illusion that you've stopped time, can't you?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think it's... Christopher does it in the book, although he never talks about it in those fashions. I mean, I think you see it among people as they get... A lot of people, as they get much older, they fall into habits.
Yes.
And I'm sure it's to some extent it's idleness. It's not encountering other people who make you do different things and think about different things all the time.
Hmm.
But I think when you get older, if you get tired, it's very soothing. I mean, from the outside, it can look tedious.
Yeah.
But it's very calming to do the same thing over and over again.
Yes, yeah.
It certainly stops you thinking about the big stuff.
Yeah. That's a whole interesting area. My mother died last year. She was 96. And, you know, she'd been doing pretty well. She'd lost her mobility when she was about 90. But the incredible thing was you could feel brain capacity shrinking. So we would have these constantly reiterated conversations and often based on some kind of misunderstanding. And sometimes it was difficult not to be irritated by that because you get, she would ask the same question over and over again about something which was not accurate. And, you know, with the best will in the world, sometimes you think, oh my God, you know, do we have to go through this again? But it was an extraordinary process. And I found, as is famously the case, you know, with very old people, they often retain long-term memory when the short-term memory becomes more and more shrunken. You know, so she could talk about her first day of going to work, her first job when she was 14 years old, and the shoes and socks she wore, you know. So going back to, you know, just after the First World War, but she couldn't remember, you know, something from... And that's extraordinary. That's really extraordinary.
It also is the reason why some people who don't undergo that process are even more astonishing. I mean, I have sort of two heroes. One, a personal friend who died recently, and someone more well known, who until a great old age managed to remain incredibly involved and vibrant and excited by the world around them. One was a friend called John, who was a headmaster and a Quaker, and I met him as a student on an Arvon course. Creative writing course, and I think he was 84 at the time, one of the liveliest people there. And one of the ways he remained interested in the world was he would always be talking to people. The last time I met him, he had recently taken his grandson, who was in a wheelchair, to a disability demo in the middle of London, which was extraordinary enough anyway. Mm. While he was having an argument, but not an argument, a discussion about the difficulty of getting a wheelchair onto a train, he started chatting to this young Nigerian woman who worked for Great Western or something. She was 22. He got on with her so well, they stayed in touch, and 6 months later, he was invited to her wedding. This 82-year-old ex-headmaster she just met over the counter.
Fantastic.
And the other person is Elliot Carter, the composer.
Oh, who's still churning it out at the age of 100 and...
And it's still amazing.
Yeah, incredible. And he's, did he recently come to this country or he's due to come?
There was a festival at the South Bank, wasn't
there? Yeah, I mean, unbelievable. That's what you hope for. If you're going to live that long, then you hope that it's like that, where you can still produce work and function and be engaged with the world.
But you can't do it by sitting at home. You have to get out and do difficult things, I think, all the time, and challenging things.
Yeah.
I was listening to one of his string quartets on my iPod the other day, going into London, and I opened my eyes. This was on Monday, the bank holiday. I opened my eyes and looked out of the window and saw the Reading Festival site, completely empty, like a war zone, just outside Reading Station. And everything was silent, and then suddenly the doors banged open, and about 100 young people came in. And I remember thinking with horror, all these young people look generic, just like sort of young people had just been poured into the carriage, and I couldn't really tell the difference between them. And I thought, this is a sign that I'm really getting older now, isn't it?
You thought there was a big bottle with young people in it.
It just being squirted into the carriage.
Squirted in. Yeah. Interesting. Something you said about this headmaster being a Quaker. I had an experience where I was giving a seminar at the School of Speech and Drama. And I asked people about significant sound memories. And two people spoke up straight away. Both of them had had sound memories that had really made an impact on them. And they both remembered them clearly. And I'm getting tired now. I've been playing all day. Both of them had been brought up as Quakers, unbeknownst to each other, even though they were in the same teaching group. And we talked about that for a bit. And the Quaker service, which is generally a slow process and quiet, and people can, I'm sure you know this, but stand up when they feel the need to say something. And it seems to give people a different approach to the world if they've been brought up in that way. And I thought of it in the previous conversation because there was a point where I paused and I was pulled up on that, you know. There's something, sometimes with students, I talk about silence and I'll sort of just kind of stop. Not laughing like this, but, you know, yeah. It's very interesting to see the reaction. That we've got to fill this with something. What's happened? Has he lost his mind? You know, has he fallen asleep? It's, oh my God, there's nothing's happening, you know.
Two things, one flippant, one serious. A friend of mine studied at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, a cellist and jazz guitarist, and one of the classes they did was active listening. Mm. And another friend who was there said, you used to go past the door and there's little sort of chicken wire mesh glass windows and you couldn't hear anything, and you looked in and you saw the room was full of people all slowly nodding like dogs in the back of cars in time with each other.
Yeah.
The more serious thing, I had a brief flirtation with Quakerism, if that's the right word, which it probably isn't,
yes.
Many years ago. And I did find the meetings incredibly moving. Mm. I don't know how many people have been in a Quaker meeting. Obviously, the quality of silence is very important, being centered and being still. But what I found most moving was that some of the people who got up to talk said something very interesting, and you got a lot out of it. Some people got up and said things which would make you move away from them on the bus. But they were listened to in exactly the same way. Mm. And you had to sit there and you had to listen. And what dawned on you very quickly was that even those people had really interesting things to say, because you had to put yourself in their mind, think about why they were saying that, why they needed to say that. And that for me was the most important thing at the center of Quakerism, the listening, not to listening to the good things in the world, but listening to everything and taking something away from absolutely everything.
Well, if you slow down, it is more possible to allow the space for, you know, this kind of disturbing, rebarbative, whatever, opinions. But if everything is very quick, then stuff gets dismissed very quickly, doesn't it? I mean, all sorts of stuff gets dismissed very quickly.
I've been thinking about this recently, partly because of writing a play. I had many difficulties with writing a play, many things I didn't really understand. One of them was that I have a very strong visual imagination, so I'd always try to be direct a play in my head. And it took me a long time to realise you can't do that. You have to just write the words and make the words stand up on their own completely and then hand them over to someone else. And that only really clicked when I started reading the plays of Martin Crimp, who sometimes uses no stage directions whatsoever. Mm. And I thought, I'll take that. Mm. Another important thing was I talked to a friend, Simon Stevens, the playwright, whose punk rock has just opened at the Lyric in Hammersmith, and I urge everyone to go, because it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But he said to me, the difference between film and stage is that film, you have to get the scenes over and done with as quickly as you possibly can, because you've got to tell the story.
Yeah.
What you have to do on stage is to keep people talking for as long as you can while it's still interesting.
Yeah.
Or indeed being silent.
Mm. Mm.
There's some, and because it's live, silence can have a kind of dramatic pressure to it that's even stronger than talking.
Oh,
and you can't do silence in films because that screen is keeping you on one side and them on the other, and you're not involved.
Yeah.
And if it's silent, you just sort of switch off.
Well, that question of whether you switch off is, I think, incredibly interesting. There are a lot of films which have a great deal of silence in them, I think. I mean, there was a vogue in particularly new Japanese, Korean cinema, where most of the characters said virtually nothing. And it's kind of, you know, strange. It's some characters would say nothing at all, you know, I mean, you could extrapolate, you could imagine what that signified in cultural and political terms, but it's the need to have something going on. You get this in music as well. I know of people who work at the extreme end of minimalism. So, for example, two notes in an hour. And of course, you have that problem of engagement and trying to find a form, don't you? Like, can we cope? Can our humanness cope with that?
And of course, it's utterly dependent on being live, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I go to the theatre if I've got an evening free, because it only happens once and you're there, you're involved. Most films I watch on DVD, which A, means I've watched the first half of more films than people have mostly watched whole films. But also,
is that because you've got young children?
I get very bored. A bad film is just a wasted evening. A bad play is really interesting to me because I like to see the wires and the wheels working. So I can think, now I see how that works and how that doesn't work. I have no idea where I was going with that.
No, you didn't, did you? But I don't actually think it matters because, you know, going somewhere is part of the problem in a way. It's.
You sound like my psychotherapist.
Well, we could try it out. It would pay more than what I do already, I'm sure. And be more reliable kind of income. Sorry, that sounds like a slur on you.
I think what I was going to say was the way cinema is going, more and more people are watching films on DVD or on their computer or something, and that means that certain kinds of filmmaking are going to become very difficult because you haven't got someone trapped in a darkened room.
Yes.
Whereas the theatre always has that. That's the precondition of it being theatre. But it's going to get harder and harder on film.
I don't know. I mean, films, you can come at them you can have gaps. So you can watch a lot of half films, but if you watch a half film that you then think, well, actually, maybe that was good, you can go back and watch the whole of the film. But you've got a long delay. And that is kind of fascinating, I think, that you can reconnect with something that maybe you had abandoned. You know, it's something, obviously you can do it with books. And we've all got books that we've abandoned. I mean, I'm a huge Joseph Conrad fan, and I've read everything except his so-called masterpiece, Nostromo, which I've tried to read about 10 times. And I think the furthest I've got is about page 36.
You keep trying?
I keep trying, and I think at some point in my life, I will finish this damn book. But film, you could never do that, could you? Because films will come to the cinema, they'd disappear.
Yeah.
They've maybe come up in kind of repertory or some special cinema, but
I had an experience with Proust rather like that.
Haven't we all?
I kept stopping it and starting, and one summer I took all the three Terence Kilmartin Penguin paperbacks away and thought, now I'll do it.
Yeah.
I got halfway through the third volume, so 2,500 pages in, and I found pencil marks from when I'd read it before. I thought, I've read nearly all of Proust and forgot that I'd done it.
So not only do you write novels and forget that you've written them, but you read huge novels and forget that you've read them. With Proust, that's so galling that you could actually read the damn thing, which hardly anybody has, and forget.
I do have a very bad memory, and I used to think, wouldn't it be great to have a library in your head where you stored everything and could retrieve it? But I've had to come to terms with the fact that I've got a compost heap in there.
Yeah.
And good stuff comes out, but I can't retrieve it in whole pieces.
That's how...